In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yes, it's true. It's time for us to talk movies. To do that, we turn every week at this time to Alan Adams of The Main Edge. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Your Monday's going all right, I hope.
Oh, yeah. So far, so good.
Glad to hear that. Weekend, how was that?
Well, I don't know. You may have seen on Facebook, Rich, but I had to put on long pants this weekend.
I did see that, and I wasn't going to bring it up because I know it's a tragic time for you every year when that day finally comes, when you give in to the elements.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, you briefly debate powering through, and you're like, you know what? It's not even like it's like 50, it's 40 degrees outside, you know? It's 8 degrees above freezing. I should probably have my legs covered.
Well,
I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But, at some point, even the hardiest of us must concede to the elements.
Yeah, you need to explain that to young Graham Kimball, who walked to school today in short pants.
Oh, that's attaboy. Yeah, well, you're young, man. That's a young man's game. the whole wintertime shorts wearing. Yeah. I wish him well.
His legs were a little red, but he's not going to admit that he was cold.
Oh no, he's not going to tell you at all. That's fantastic. I wholeheartedly approve.
I thought of you. We have so many talented writers on the program this week. We have Jonathan Lethem tomorrow. Are you a fan of his work?
I am. I heard you guys mention Fortress of Solitude. That's a really good one. Chronic City is great.
Mm.
His short fiction is wonderful. Like, he's just got a really body of work. I'm really looking forward. I've already got a copy in hand of his latest one, and I'm very much looking forward to reading it.
And I'm trying to remember you. I believe you told me. I think about. Milltown, the Cary Arsenault book.
That's right. Yeah, we did a combined review interview cover story about Cary here back in about a month and a half ago, give or take, something like that. It's funny actually. I saw your guest list upcoming, and I'm like, oh man. Well, discussing the cover story of The Main Edge this week is going to be difficult because he's going to be pretty talked out about the Word Festival, because that's what our cover is going to be this week.
Yeah, I can't talk about it enough because they do such a great job every year, and what a phenomenal lineup this year.
Well, it's great, and it's like, one of the parts of the story is I sort of talk to them a little bit about the pivot to digital, considering current circumstances, and what that was like. And it really, obviously you can't make any guarantees ahead of time, but it really looks like they've got all their ducks in a row and they've got something really great planned for folks. So I'm very much looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, we'll talk more about that Wednesday. Let's talk movies. You saw a trio of them this weekend. I saw one of the three you watched. Which one do you want to talk about?
All right. So here's the thing. Right? I've been thinking about this today. There's one movie on this list. it rhymes with Spit House. The title. And don't get me wrong, an excellent movie, a wonderful piece of indie filmmaking by a young man. He's just 23 years old, written, directed, starring. His name's Cooper Rafe. Jay Duplass was a producer on this film. He's part of the reason it got made. Won the Grand Jury Prize at South by Southwest. Like, this wonderful coming-of-age story. And Rich, I don't think we have time to talk about it today because of the other two movies.
Okay.
Because I desperately want to talk to you about the trial of the Chicago Seven, which you particularly fit very squarely in the center of the of the assorted circles that make the Venn diagram of people who will like this movie. So I feel like it's very important that we talk about that. And I'll be real with you, Rich. We could spend the entire time talking about American Utopia because. That was a movie going experience, unlike anything I think I've really experienced in a very long time.
Let's start with that because I watched that myself. I actually watched it twice over the weekend because I don't know the last time I had a movie experience, certainly not in my own home, that was as joyful as watching David Byrne and that incredible band.
Well, it's, you know, the remarkable thing about it is, like, I mean, David Byrne's always been about connection, like, whether it's within his music or within his activism or what have you. He's all about the connections between people. It's something that he addresses numerous times during his very funny and very engaging sort of interstitial moments in American Utopia. So it's not a huge surprise to me that he would be able to sort of mine those connections even in this sort of this format. I mean, it doesn't hurt that, you know, Spike Lee is directing the film, you know, like he's another one who has such a great gift as far as human connection is concerned. You know, it's funny, I was thinking about it, and it's both strange and completely predictable that David Byrne is the centerpiece of two of the five greatest concert films ever made.
Yeah.
I think this qualifies in that conversation. I really do. It's, you know, I don't know that it quite reaches the level set by Stop Making Sense, but it's so much closer than I thought it was possible to get. And that movie's 36 years old. Like, watching Byrne up there for an hour and a half, you know, he's 68 years old. And you watch all his, you know, all the band, these young people, like these enthusiastic and wonderfully energetic and incredibly talented people just sweating and just really, and you look at Byrne and it's like, it's like he just walked out of the dressing room. Like, yeah. It's unbelievable looking at a guy like that, who's able to sort of, to just be such a wonderfully engaging and empathetic performer. I think that's the thing that I think really shines in this movie, is you really get that sense of human compassion and empathy. It just radiates from him. There are some real bangers as far as the music is concerned. So it was just really just a remarkable experience.
And bringing some of those songs, which are, you know, 35, 40 years old in some cases, putting them in a setting that makes them seem as new and fresh as ever.
Yeah, like that was something that really I thought was really wonderful, and I think, you know, obviously the staging of the show plays a huge part in this, but also, you know, the work that Spike Lee is doing, like, you know, the knowing where to focus when, like the switching from stationary cameras to handhelds to sort of get you into the sort of the joyful chaos of it all. Because
right. The overhead shots are so great.
Well, and it's like, you know, at one point you're sitting there and it's like, you know, it's a, you know, Burning Down the House is playing. Just one of the greatest songs of the last, you know, 40 years. And all of a sudden it's like, switches to an overhead shot and they're full on marching bandit. Like, it's like the coolest marching band you've ever watched. And it's just happening. And it's so, like, beautifully choreographed, and, like, I could just go on and on. Like, you know, the stuff with, you know, the transition from Everybody's Coming to My House to Once in a Lifetime, like, that was a beautiful moment.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the shadow play when they did Blind, like, all of that, like, just so many wonderful things. The, oh my God, the closer, the a cappella version of One Fine Day.
Oh, man.
Like, you know, because you're already coming off that, frankly, I teared up, like goosebumps, the whole shebang when they did that the cover of that Janelle Monáe song.
Yes,
Combat.
So powerful.
And that, well, it's so powerful, and that right there, I think, was a perfect example of why David Byrne and Spike Lee were the perfect pairing to make something like this. Because they both bring that sort of revolutionary, progressive energy, but they're coming at it from different directions. But they're able to sort of meet in the middle in a way that really not only it's very complimentary. It actually each elevates the other in the way that they're sort of making these expressions. So it was just, yeah, I can't say enough good things about it. It's burned into my brain in a way that I just I don't think I expected. And I mean, it's like, oh yeah, it's Jonathan, it's David Byrne, it's Spike Lee. Like, obviously it's going to be good, but I have in my head these, you know, classic concert films. Yes, Stop Making Sense, but also stuff like The Last Waltz, or even like Prince's Sign of the Times, like these incredible concert films from the past. And it's like, you know, part of you's like, well, they can't do that anymore. And it turns out, Yeah, they can. You just have to have the right people involved, and this project very much did so. And I'm so jazzed that that people are going to have a chance to see this. You know, even if it is in their homes, because you know who knows when the live show is coming back. You know, they were slated to make a return to Broadway this fall. Obviously, that's not happening. You know, you hope that you know down the road that's able to happen, and people will be able to see the show live again, but. I don't know how much closer you can get to capturing that sort of live experience than what we see in this film. It's just unbelievable.
I agree completely. All right, I haven't seen it yet. I can't wait. I mean, the story already had me, but then I saw the amazing cast for the Trial of the Chicago 7, and I can't wait.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm someone who, you know, who has a good deal of fascination with this particular period in American history. Like, I've, you know, and it's funny because, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I'm, you know, taking, you know, high school history in the early 90s, you know, our history kind of stopped, like, right after, right after World War II. Like, that's basically as far as we got in American history. And so I didn't really learn about this period of time until I got to college. And, you know, to learn about, you know, the Chicago 7, to learn about what went on at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, to learn about the counterculture that was both completely indicative of and totally beyond the sort of hippie stereotype, you know, to realize that all these people were out there and that, you know, their government had tried really hard to just make them go away and was willing to do whatever it took to make them go away. And so to see that story sort of brought to the screen by someone who, frankly, I don't know who else writes this movie other than Aaron Sorkin. Like, I don't know. I don't know who else you would trust to bring this particular story to life. And yes, like Sorkin's brand of progressivism, you know, he definitely tends to insert his own ideals into the stories that he tells, whether or not they're being told by, you know, about real people or not. And I acknowledge that, but, there are a few people who can, you know, who can make this sort of, especially a courtroom drama, just sing like Sorkin does. And he directs as well, which is something that I was maybe a little more apprehensive about, but he's smart enough to sort of to let his words do the work and kind of largely get out of the way, especially since, as you mentioned, the cast is just stacked. You've got, you know, like, I mean, I could just run through the list, and it's just like, you know, you're basically going through like the Oscar nominations for the next 5 to 10 years. You know, you're talking about, you know, like Eddie Redmayne and Sacha Baron Cohen and Jeremy Strong, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, Mark Rylance is here, Frank Langella is here. Like, it's just, like, there are, like, legitimately, like, half a dozen performances in this movie that will warrant attention. Like, obviously, you can't nominate everybody. Although, this year, who knows? Like, considering the sort of the way the movie schedules are being sort of shuffled and moved around, like maybe there will be room for multiple nominations for a movie like this. But it's just like having Sorkin bring his particular energy to a story like this, to a story of idealism and what it means to be, you know, to maintain your principles and your ideals in the face of a machine that wants nothing more than to grind you down is just incredible. So the basic gist, you know, to be honest, I don't know how you do a basic gist as far as the Chicago 7 is concerned, because there's so much going on.
Right.
But the basic deal is a group of counterculture figures were indicted by the U.S. government for conspiracy to cross state lines to incite violence at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. The figures involved, you've got Tom Hayden, That's Eddie Redmayne, and Rennie Davis, played by Alex Sharp, from the Students for a Democratic Society, the SDS. You've got Abby Hoffman, that's Sacha Baron Cohen, and Jerry Rubin, Jeremy Strong, from the Youth International Party, the Yippies. And then you've got Bobby Seale, Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who's phenomenal in this. Like, this dude is like he's going to be like, and then he's going to be a star. I don't know if it's next year or if it's in the next 5 years or what have you, but he is going to be a star. And Bobby Seale, who's one of the co-founders of the Black Panther Party, as well as a number of other individuals. And they're sort of called in to stand trial for these charges. They're being prosecuted by a guy named Richard Schultz, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who was recruited directly by Attorney General John Mitchell to seek these indictments. And then you've got this month-long trial that happens that's presided over by a judge, Judge Julius Hoffman, played by Frank Langella, who is both maybe getting a little long in the tooth and is actively antagonistic towards the defendants, which is not an ideal combination for a fair trial. And so you get this, you know, meanwhile, the defendants are being, they're being defended by attorney William Kunstler, played by Mark Rylance, who, again, Mark Rylance is someone, just stand there, Mark. Like, you don't even have to say anything. Like, just his face and his physicality is just so compelling. But yeah, so he's defending, and you basically get a month-long trial with lots of contempt charges and inappropriate courtroom business, including one that leads to Bobby Seale being declared, his individual case being declared a mistrial, and him moved to another situation for reasons that I will not spoil. although if you've read history, you're aware of how it went. And in the meantime, we also get a look behind the scenes at the tensions that the trial raises and how they affect the sort of relationships between all these individuals, a lot of whom didn't even know each other before the events surrounding the National Convention, despite what the government would have the jury believe. Conspiracy is really hard when you've never met someone up until the supposed conspiracy is taking place. But yeah, you know, it's Sorkin at his Sorkiniest. Like, it's very, the dialogue's very dense and quippy, high impact, and everybody gets these like chewy speeches and those sort of sharp edged like bon mots that Sorkin's so good at, and these wonderfully ideologically charged conversations that are just so compelling to watch. And again, like I said, Sorkin the director, maybe not quite as deft as Sorkin the screenwriter, but I mean, he knows courtroom drama, and he knows enough to set it up and just let the cast cook, because he stacked it. Like, there's the only way he could screw it up is to get in the way. He knows enough to sort of figure out how to balance the legal proceedings with the outside interactions, and this is key, I think. He does intercut some real documentary footage of the events that led to the crimes for which they're being tried. So basically, we get to see some documentary footage of the riots and the other sort of unrest that was happening in Chicago at that time, which is really, it's a really fascinating sort of way to really ground what we're watching in reality. But again, like I said, the performances, like, we're going to be talking a lot about these guys when we go into awards season. The best and the breakout performance is probably Sacha Baron Cohen. His Abby Hoffman, despite a, I'll be generous and call it questionable Boston accent. I mean, he's a force of nature. Like at first glance, it's like, that's kind of a weird casting decision. But like, Cohen is, it turns out, the perfect guy to sort of capture like Abby Hoffman's blend of like weirdo charisma and like righteous energetic fury. Like, that's a really tough like balance to strike, and he does it beautifully. Redmayne is great as Tom Hayden. He provides a wonderful counterpoint to the sort of, he's the ice to you know, Abbie Hoffman's fire, and so you have a really nice sort of juxtaposition between the two of them. You know, and it's a lot subtler than we usually get from Eddie Redmayne, and that's a good thing. Like, he tends to really go for it in ways that don't always work, and he's really reined himself in a little bit, and I think that's important. Jeremy Strong, who's so good on Succession, he's great as Jerry Rubin, like, just like stoner absurdist hippie extraordinaire, like basically embodying everything that the squares are scared of about hippies. Like, he's that guy. And I mentioned Abdul-Mateen, who's just mesmerizing as Bobby Steele. Like, you can't take your eyes off him. And he's going to be, he's for real. Like, we're going to see a lot from him. You know, and the rest, like, don't necessarily get as much to do in comparison. But everybody's great. You know, like I said, Rylance is wonderful. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is great. Like, they're wonderful sort of foes on opposite sides of the case. And Langella is great as Judge Hoffman. Like, he is so stupid and evil, and just basically, like, the performance practically begs you to just stand up and hiss. Like, he's that big of a villain. Now, to be fair, this movie takes its share of liberties as far as the facts are concerned. Like, Sorkin's never been... I liken it to this. My basic take on Aaron Sorkin is, he's not someone who's going to let facts get in the way of the truth. which... you know, I think he's always got the grander truth in mind. He's keeping an eye on the big picture, and if some of the details get altered for the sake of you know, dramatic license, I think that's okay, because, you know, he's able to sort of capture the spirit, if not necessarily always the letter. Obviously, this film feels very timely, considering the state of affairs these days. I have to say, it's a really fantastic representation of a moment in our history that maybe we don't remember as clearly as we ought to. We should really maybe take pains to keep this at the forefront of our minds, because, you know, there were a lot of people who fought a lot for their principles and for causes that I think, you know, we reaped the rewards of those fights for a long time, and I feel like we're starting to maybe move backwards a little bit.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, it's guys like this that remind us of, just how much power the voice of the individual can have.
No question, but I can't wait to see it. Trial of Chicago 7, one of three from Alan Adams this week on Downtown. Thank you, Al. Look forward to catching up with you on Wednesday when the paper comes out.
Yep, we'll talk to you then.
You got it. Thanks, Al.